Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Generation Y ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible. Starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees. So I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in two orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
I'm doing good, Justin. How are you?
I'm still recovering, but I'm feeling good.
We've gotten quite the response to our latest premium episode that we released on Patreon, and it's now on our website and will be on iTunes hopefully in a week or two.
That'd be some flat earth business going on there.
Anyway, it's been a great response. If you haven't heard it, then get on Patreon.
Learn all the truth about how the earth is flat. You did a little guest spot on another show, didn't you?
One of our listeners has his own podcast, and it's One Gay Guy. And I would recommend checking out the interview I did with him. It was pretty fun.
And I just did a interview with Jeremy at Podcast We Listen To for The Peripheral. So we both did guest spots on other shows. Really fun stuff.
And a little shout out to Ellie. And for those of you in Kansas City, we'll be at Noir Arts and Oddities on 39th Street in Kansas City on August 18th at 6 p.m. It's an oddity shop and it's pretty cool. So if you're in town, come down and check it out and hang out with us.
What are we talking about tonight, Aaron?
Tonight is the acid bath murderer, aka John George Haig.
And when and where did this happen?
This is a case out of England.
UK.
And it happens in the 1940s. And John George Haig was, what would you say, a dapper-looking man?
Yeah. If he was alive today, he'd be a little hipster.
He was well-groomed, well-dressed, played the part of a successful businessman very well. But that was just people taking him at his appearance, judging the book by its cover, as it were. In reality, this man was a fraudster.
Con artist.
And eventually, after having served some stints in prison, he decided that he was done with that. Not done with crime, just done with getting caught. And he devised a plan so that he would make his victims disappear.
No victim, no crime. Yeah. He was born in July 1909 in Lincolnshire, England.
He was born to John and Emily Haig. John Robert Haig, his father, was an engineer, and he earned a decent wage. And the family always lived in decent homes. I would say considered middle class. He had a pretty good upbringing. His parents loved him. The family was religious, and their religion was Plymouth Brethren.
I've never even heard of that.
I hadn't heard of it either. But essentially, the only kind of entertainment that young John could have was the Bible. He couldn't play sports. It was considered a pretty strict religion. And this will possibly factor in later.
Oh, it definitely factors in.
His mother probably had a big influence on John because she felt as though their family was better than other families. She said that she considered them God's elect. His father, John, had a blue scar on his forehead that looked like a distorted cross. And when his son asked him about it, he said that he had been branded by Satan for sinning. And so then he asked, well, why doesn't mom have one? And he said, that's because your mother's an angel. I don't know if that's romantic or if he had to come up with something, if he had to ad lib on the spot. But that was his explanation for why his wife didn't have a scar. Around age 10, John began singing in the choir at Wakefield Cathedral. This cathedral is of a different faith than Plymouth Brethren, but his parents didn't mind too much because they liked to see him involved in Christian activities, as it were.
He also played piano too. I'm sure this was learned during choir.
He also attended classes there, and he didn't understand why the faiths were different. Some believe that he began to lose faith knowing that there were two different religions that were similar, but quite different. And they used the same source, essentially, but they just had different interpretations of the scriptures. He very much focused on subjects in school that he did well at because he was interested in them. If he wasn't interested in a subject, then his grades reflected that. His peers would claim that John was mischievous and threatening at times, but that his parents were never informed because they were not approachable. They said that his father was very strict and that his mother felt like the family was superior, so they couldn't just go over and talk to them about their son, who might have been causing them some trouble. John's nickname when he was young was Ching due to his eyes, and he didn't have much of a social life.
This is their way to dismiss a kid in class that comes from a uppity family or thinks that he's better than everyone else. So they have to come up with a way to knock him off his pedestal.
And of course, they weren't too worried about the insensitivity of their remarks.
Not in the 1940s, no.
At age 17, he was done with school. His first notable job after this was his nearly 3-year stint at Shell Mex Limited. It was a garage where he posted information for customers on the cars that were for sale there. John was in love with cars. I'm not sure about in love with women. That's a debatable item, but he loved cars.
I think he was a showboat, a show off, and he liked the high roller kind of image. So the car is what gives a man his status, and then just what goes with that image. It's all the idea of, and really has nothing to do with anything of substance.
As we cover this, you'll see that John wasn't exactly a guy that was traditional, and it could be because of his religious upbringing. Maybe he sort of rebelled against that and didn't want to follow in his parents' footsteps. Within 7 years, he was selling auto insurance. He was buying cars. Now, how would he afford cars if he's not making a large wage?
It's a little bit of side work, one could say.
Yeah, apparently John became very good at forging signatures and documents.
Oh, that doesn't sound legal at all.
But hey, if you have 3 cars, then who cares how you got them, right? He has 3 cars.
Yeah, and he was selling cars to other people that didn't exist. So people would send money. There would be no car to be had. He also was doing some scams with stocks, I think, and other kind of mutual funds.
In 1934, he marries a woman named Beatrice. She definitely did not come from money. But of course, John is walking around as though he has money. And that may have been part of the attraction. She'd never found out where his money came from, according to her, it seemed like. But as we said, John was committing fraud by forging documents. At one point, he made over 500 pounds from the Mercantile Union Guarantee Company. Just months after they were married, John was arrested. She was very, very concerned, wanted to know what was going on. And he said, "It's nothing. Don't worry about it." But it's because he, along with two accomplices, tried to defraud Motor Credit Services Limited. One of the giveaways was the form that they had filled out contained a misspelling. They levied a number of charges against him and his accomplices, and he was given a sentence of 15 months in prison in November of 1934.
And his wife, obviously concerned about why her husband's going to jail, also is pregnant with their child. Who's going to raise this child? Who's going to support her and the child? This is not a good situation for her to be in. Who knows how long he's going to be behind bars? Yeah, he's only sentenced to 15 months, but if he's on bad behavior, if he does something while he's in there, there's no telling when he's getting out. And she's not going to stick around, is she?
Well, she may not have much choice because her family didn't have any money and she wasn't getting any word from John. He ignored her completely. In the end, she would have to adopt her daughter out. His parents stayed in contact with their son. His father would write letters that were of a very religious nature. John would write back and tell them he was very sorry for what he did. He was sorry for dragging their name through the mud, that he would make sure to redeem himself if he was given the chance. Then he started boasting about how well he was doing in prison. He said that he was becoming quite the tailor and he was making mailbags and trousers, pajamas and jackets. In December of 1935, he's released, not having served his whole time.
Yeah, good behavior.
John gets out of prison. As he said, he wants to redeem himself, right? Well,
no.
Yeah, that was in the letter. That's to, I don't know, send some fluff to his parents, I guess. He gets into the dry cleaning business with Major Plackett, which sounds, he sounds like a very distinguished gentleman. Well, he thought he was doing very well in that business, but unfortunately, an automobile accident killed his partner. That left Major Plackett's widow in charge, and she decided to liquidate the her part of the business, and so John had to sell out too.
And John, just knowing his personality and his schemes, he wasn't going to do any real work, so he could not have continued this business. So when she liquidated her end, he wasn't going to lift a finger, so he's just going to get his money too.
The funny thing about Major Plackett is that he was John's lawyer when he was going to court for the business.
For the fraud scheme that he was engaged in.
Yeah, just prior to going to prison. As I said, John's not a very sociable guy. He puts on a very good act. He seems very distinguished and he seems like he has money, but he doesn't have a social life. But he meets a man by the name of William Donald McSwan. He's interviewed by him for work. And, well, William really likes him. And not only does he hire him, they start hanging out after work.
Yeah, and he's his driver, so they get a lot of time together. And, I mean, high roller, I mean, you're driving somebody around. That means they have money if they can afford to pay somebody to drive them.
Yeah, McSwan had a pin table business, which I think is like a pinball machine. John was giving him ideas about how to attract more people to spend their money there.
Because John's always looking for the angle.
John met William's parents and he even introduced them to his own mother and they hung out some. Under aliases, John acted as a solicitor and after visiting the public company's registry, had the details of shareholders and company directors with which to mail his letters. With these letters, he was informing the recipients that he was offering shares below value to liquidate them from different estates.
This is like a dream come true for the buyers. I mean, this is a buyer's market. They can get a share for really cheap, but this is like Wall Street or Boiler Room. It's probably too good to be true.
And some people did react that way. They said, this is too good to be true. But as with any scam, you don't need everyone to respond. You just need enough. And the scheme worked for a bit. When he was caught, John claimed that he was working for someone else and tried to deny all responsibility for the schemes. Near the end of November 1937, fraud charges were brought against him, and it was too strong a case. he really had no hope of winning the court battle.
He was pretty crafty, though, because he would sell these shares, but then he would sign his name as other members of an office of, like, for deliveries, or there'd be a certified mail. So he was trying to distance himself from being the main office manager, when really the whole thing was just him. But he was kind of crafty, but at the end of the day, the courts are like, no, this is you, and you're defrauding people with bunk shares.
Yeah, the judge even admonished him for trying to pull a fast one on him. He saw right through the lies, and he was found guilty and given 4 years in prison. He was in prison from November 37 through August of 1940. He appealed for early release, and they gave it to him. So you would think John would learn his lesson, but no. He committed some theft of some bunk beds, some curtains, and some kitchen utensils, and that again landed him in prison. June 11th, 1941, he's back in prison. Now, his parents, they're strict, but that's more about the faith. They love their son, and they're supporting him. They mail him, if he needs something, they mail it to him. They write to him. And of course, he's still saying that he'll reform himself. I don't think they really care at this point. They just love their son, and they're supporting him. And he's their only son. Do you think that has something to do with it?
Oh, absolutely. And they don't want to lose him because he's all they got.
This is now his third stint in prison. He was given a 21-month sentence, that's almost 2 years. And of course, he goes to different prisons. While he's at Lincoln Prison, Haig started experimenting with field mice and sulfuric acid. And he's doing tests to see how long the acid takes to destroy these mice. Again, this is something that you can't even say it's speculation. He is plotting for the future. He is done with being in prison. What do you think he's going after? Or what do you think he's going for with this?
Well, in these experiments, he found out that it took about half an hour for the acid to dissolve a mouse. So then he takes the weight of the mouse and then times that by however much to a human body. And now you're getting rid of the witness, the victim, the person that he's conned. So there's nobody to report the crime. He had access to the workshop in the prison, and he had tobacco and other things that either his parents would send or he would scheme in prison, and he would pay other prisoners with this tobacco or money to go collect field mice to bring back to him, because other prisoners had, I guess, more laxed sentences where they could leave the grounds and come back on the weekends, or they had work release programs, whereas he couldn't go anywhere. That's how he would collect these mice and collect the acid and all these different utensils that he would need to do his experiment.
Yeah, the prison had a tin shop, and that's where he was allowed to work with sulfuric acid. September 1943, he's released, and then he was employed by and lived with Alan Stevens. And Stevens and his wife Evelyn had a teenage daughter named Barbara. She was about 15 years old, and she and Mr. Haig started a relationship.
It's a little bit outside of the age zone, I think.
Yeah, he's about twice her age.
Mm-hmm.
The Stevens didn't really like it. I think they were sort of at odds with this because they kind of liked Mr. Haig, but they didn't like their daughter dating him because they felt she was too immature or too young.
Absolutely. Even today, I mean, yeah, just not good.
Now, it's in August of 1944 when John Haig locates three basement rooms for rent in a building, and he negotiates a price, and then he moved in on September 6, 1944, and this is the start of his new life.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly, or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles, and immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
The day after he moves in, he places an order for 6 pounds of muriatic acid, which is an impure form of hydrochloric acid, and he orders 20 gallons of sulfuric acid. This stuff is delivered the same day.
You can buy a lot of these acids today. I have a pool. I buy muriatic acid to balance my pH in my pool. And nobody's questioning me about it. I mean, you can go to a pool supply store. You can go to hardware stores. You can buy this stuff.
A couple days later, he brings William McSwan with him to his basement rooms. And coming up behind him, he hits him, as he would say it, he coshes him with, it's either a piece of pipe or a table leg. And he says that it takes William about 5 minutes to die.
This is his friend. This is the guy that he got along with and looked up to. And he just beat him over the head.
Well, John Haig needed money.
Absolutely. To fund his new con.
He's not very social in the sense that he has a bunch of friends that he socializes with. He just likes to show up places and spend a lot of money, show up in a nice car, and impress people. That's what he's doing. It's a big show, and he needs money. He's not going to earn it legitimately. He's looking at his buddy William McSwan and thinking, hey, you're here. I can just take you out and take your money.
And McSwan was working for his parents, collecting rent from different apartments and flats around London. And they made pretty good money because they were landlords. But John realizes pretty quick that, oh, it's not McSwan that had all the money. It's his parents.
Yeah, McSwan's parents, their names were on the businesses. After killing William, he removes all of his valuables that he has on him. Then he put him in a drum and filled it with sulfuric acid.
Probably 40, 50 gallons worth of acid. And he has to wear rubber boots, a jacket, a meat apron, and then big rubber gloves like the kinds you see in either slaughterhouses or what electricians use to work on power lines.
Now, he should have worn a gas mask because these acids have very strong fumes. And when he was trying to dispose of his friend's body in this manner, the fumes were getting to him and he kept having to run outside to get fresh air. And he did this over and over again as he was using a bucket to fill the drum up with this acid.
Again, back to when I put chemicals in my pool, there's times where the chlorine itself just, it burns my face and my eyes and my nostrils and I have to take a step back. And if you mix the acid and the chlorine together and you get a dangerous poisonous cloud that can kill you. So this isn't stuff you mess around with. And for him to, I mean, I get it. He's wearing gloves and heavy coats and stuff to protect him from splash, but he didn't think ahead enough to protect his face, his eyes, and his mouth and nose. That's kind of funny.
I think there's an explanation for that, and we'll get to that a little later. The next day, William McSwan is basically a lumpy liquid, and John Hague dumped this down a drain. So there goes the evidence, right?
Yeah.
Then he went about convincing the man's parents that their son, William, had gone away to avoid conscription. This is to avoid having to go to the war.
Because World War II is in full force right now. And he even goes so far to forge documents to show that McSwan has left the country.
He sent fake postcards to them, just keeping up this ruse.
Now he sets his sights on the parents, the real money behind this operation.
Yeah, this is in July of 1945.
So their son was the rent collector. Well, he's gone now. So John befriends the parents, gets close with them, takes on their son's job collecting the money. This is sort of the talented Mr. Ripley kind of situation here, where he's weaseling his way into other people's lives just with the long con in mind. Eventually, he's making money off the parents doing these jobs, but then that's just not enough, is it?
So he's committing fraud this whole time, but he wants more. He wants to take the McSwans for everything they have, and the only way to do that is to murder them.
He tells Donald that their son has returned and is down in the basement of one of his properties. And if he wants to reunite with his son, to come on over and head down into the basement. When Donald enters the basement looking for his son that he hasn't seen for quite a while, Hague will hit him in the back of the head and bludgeon him to death. He will then go and retrieve Amy and do the same ruse. She walks down into the basement and gets the same treatment as Donald.
And in that basement are two drums just waiting for bodies.
I always wondered, they don't really go into this, but I always wondered if he dismembered them first or if he just was able to pick up the entire body and dump it in and then start dumping the acid on top of them. Because I would assume that that's a lot of weight to move around. But they didn't find any sign of dismemberment. So he's having to pick up these bodies and drop them in a barrel.
On July 6th, he vacated that property. But before he did so, he dumped the contents of those two drums down the drain, forever getting rid of the remains of the McSwans. He ended up making more than 5,000 pounds from selling off assets and collecting rents. And sadly, no one reported the McSwan family as missing because they didn't stay in contact with their family, with their relatives, and they didn't really have any friends. No one was really concerned about this.
No. So it was the perfect crime for John.
In 1945, John Hague had met Edward Jones, who was a managing director of Hursley Products Limited in Crawley. It was an engineering and toolmaking business. They ended up having an agreement where John would run errands for Jones, and then John was permitted to use a storeroom.
For his business.
Well, he had the basement that he had for a while, the three rooms in the basement, but on July 6th, he had left. So he needed a new place to conduct his business, which is murder.
Yeah.
So then he got a storeroom, and that was his new place to commit murder. But this storeroom did not have a drain.
It didn't have a basement. It was a one-story building in kind of a construction yard. It didn't have a drain. It didn't have a basement. So all he has is a rubbled yard around a building. But with this $5,000 he's made from McSwan's, he's living a pretty high-end lifestyle. What was the average salary or wage at the time?
People are maybe making about £5 a week.
So he's come into £5,000. This is a lot of money. This is years of salary. And he stays at high-end hotels and finds high-class bars and restaurants to go rub shoulders with the elite. But he blows through all that money pretty quick because he's got a really expensive taste.
In 1947, there's a couple named Henderson. The thing to know about them is the man is a doctor. And originally, he and his wife had a pretty troubled relationship, and he was carrying on an affair with a woman named Rosalie. And his wife wasn't very comfortable with this, but his wife ends up falling ill and dying, allowing him to go on and marry Rosalie. So he married Rosalie, and things weren't exactly rosy there either, if you catch my drift. They were looking to sell a property, and they posted an ad. John Hague answered the ad, and Rosalie had stated that the property would sell for £8,750. But John told her that no, that's below what it should be. It should be £10,500, and that's what I'll pay you. Well, she doesn't think, wow, you're a wonderful human being. She thinks you're stupid. In the meantime, she ended up telling her brother about this, and her brother said, no, when something's too good to be true, you just turn around and go the other way. But she didn't accept that. She took the money and she sold to John Hague. John Hague sort of befriended them at this point, and they started hanging out. In fact, he spent a lot more time with Rosalie, it seemed. And as we know, he's getting close, but not because he's actually friends with them. He took them one at a time from their hotel that was in Brighton to this storeroom in Crawley. He shot them and put them in these drums full of acid. And of course, to make sure that no one is suspicious, he paid their bill for the hotel and he had taken all their valuables. The thing about the Hendersons was that they had a very similar lifestyle to John Hague. They lived beyond their means. They had overdrawn balances at the bank, and they like to spend money. And I think that's why they didn't really notice any issues with John Hague, because he seemed a lot like them. But it certainly made them easy victims for this killer. And while they may have had overdrawn balances at the bank, they still had property. In 1949, John Hague is living in a hotel in South Kensington. And he's sort of having lunch with different people. He's getting to know them. He, of course, is building himself up as this great businessman, this wealthy guy. And he's trying to charm these older women that are at the hotel. And I think a lot of them sort of see through his act, but not all of them do.
Well, he's a suave younger man. He can play the piano, drive fast cars. I think this probably doesn't appeal to a lot of them, but some of them might want to relive their youth again.
One woman that was there was Mrs. Olive Henrietta Olivia Roberts Duran Deacon. Now, the reason I say her full name is I'm surprised she has that many names. And it kind of made me laugh because normally serial killers have three names. This woman has, I mean, how many names is that?
It's like six. But with a name like that, it shows her level in society. Poor people don't really call themselves all that. So this is high class. People are very proud of their lineage. And the difference here between John Hague and most other murderers is a lot of other murderers and serial killers kill people that are either in high risk lifestyles or people that are not in the upper echelon of society. People that, I guess you would say, might not be as missed or might not have as many connections or ties to family as the people at this hotel. So it's very brazen of him to go after these people, but I think this is more about the money and the con than it is about the murder.
He's getting to know Olive, and she told him that she had come up with these false nails.
Lee press-on nails before they were cool.
He said that he was an inventor. and a businessman.
And an engineer.
He can take her false nails and improve upon them, and she loved that idea. So they work out a deal, right?
Yeah. He says, we can prototype them in my workshop, and I'll invest in your thing, and we'll make them better, and we'll make tons of money together. It's such a wonderful offer. Sounds too good to be true.
Yeah, not even 3 weeks into February, he drives her to his storeroom in Crawley, and he walked behind her, and he shot her in the back of the head.
Now he shoots her with a gun that he took from the Hendersons. So if you can imagine this upper-class woman wearing a fur coat, heels, dressed up nicely, walking through a crummy gated warehouse, she probably had a lot of trepidation going in here because it wasn't her normal scene. But it's a warehouse, and this is where you make stuff. And he was able to persuade her to go. And then he shoots her dead. Now, he removes all of her valuables, including her fur coat. As his MO dictates, he puts her in a barrel of acid. Now, when he shoots her, it probably gets her nice fur coat dirtied. So he has to get that cleaned in order to sell it, because it's worth money, right?
Well, and as you already pointed out, this woman will be missed. There are other people that are at the hotel that enjoy her company, and they notice that she's not there anymore. She wasn't expected to be missing. So the next day when she's not around, people are talking.
And just 2 days later, they're reporting her missing.
Now, John Haig tries to keep the ruse up and even asks someone if they'd seen her. And that person responded by saying, well, you were hanging out with this woman.
You were the last one to be seen with her. So it's kind of weird that you're asking if anyone else has seen her. And this is a group of women that tea together. It's the knitting group. They talk. And one of their friends is now missing.
It's about 10 days after he murdered Olive that a detective shows up and takes him back down to the station. He wanted to talk with John Haig. Too many people had noticed that it appeared as though John Haig had had lunch with Olive. So this is a good starting point for the investigation. But it doesn't exactly go as I would have predicted. John Haig admits to robbing Olive of her fur coat and her jewelry.
He just comes out and says it. He doesn't even deny it. He doesn't try to lie too much to the police. It's weird.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY.
Well, they had found these items, so it's not as though he could deny it too much, but I think he was just coming clean because they found it, and, well, it's just robbery, right?
Yeah, and they found a dry cleaning slip at his warehouse, which they went to the cleaners and found her coat, and then they found her other items. It was pretty obvious that he was the last person to be with her before her demise.
Later in the evening, the detective is still trying to get information out of him, and John ends up confessing to him. And this is what he told him. He said, I've destroyed her with acid. You'll find the sludge that remains at Leopold Road. Every trace has gone. How can you prove murder if there's no body?
He just says this outright. They say that he misunderstood the law and body of evidence, and if there's no body, then there's no evidence. But how could someone be that dumb?
earlier I had said that I could maybe explain this, and here's what I think. When he was in prison, he read a lot. In fact, they think that's partially where he got the idea to destroy people's bodies with acid, was an inspiration from a French serial killer. But I believe what happened was, even though he was reading books, he was not a great reader. And I think his ability to comprehend the information he was taking in wasn't the best. So he had an idea of what he was reading, but it wasn't what he needed to know. Like, for example, he would misspell names. That gave away his schemes on some documents. Or in this case, he's thinking that the law says that if there's no body, there's no crime. But that's not true. Corpus delicti, the facts and circumstances constituting a breach of a law or concrete evidence of a crime such as a corpse.
If his reading comprehension is pretty low, I think Latin terms are probably going to throw him for a loop.
In other words, they don't necessarily need a body to prove that he committed a crime.
Sulfuric acid doesn't get rid of you completely. There is a sludge, a residue, sometimes bone and even fat left over. I Googled this so you don't have to, but it takes about 2 days to dissolve a body in a barrel of acid. I can't even imagine if somebody looked through my history, but teeth and bone, gallstones, and I can't even imagine in today's world where we have fillings and artificial hips and bones and stuff like that, that stuff doesn't go away. So because he was at this new warehouse that didn't have a basement or a drain, he's just pouring the stuff out in the corner. So the investigators go over there and they find bone. They find some leftovers of her, of Olive.
The man in charge of collecting and examining this evidence was Dr. Keith Simpson. He was a pathologist. And he found some very interesting items. He found a hat pin at the bottom of a drum. He found blood stains and he found a gallstone. He also found dentures. These were identified as Olive's dentures by her dentist. And again, he's misunderstood what he read. And in fact, that's what brings him down. They have enough evidence to be sure that he's not going to win in court.
I mean, and he straight up admitted to it. He confessed to it. He confessed to multiple people, people that they never found, thinking, okay, nah, I can say whatever I want. But as soon as he starts to realize that they can press charges, they can go after the death penalty, he changes his tune and he starts acting crazy.
Yeah, he says that before he disposed of the bodies, that he drank their blood, that was the motivation for the killings.
He says this pretty early on, and this is, again, he's a salesman, he's a con man. He is always looking for that angle, he's always looking for that out. So insanity plea is his best bet. Now, at the time, they bring in experts that say, you couldn't drink a pint of blood, you would throw it up and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, really, are we really shooting down whether or not somebody can drink a pint of blood? Because I've seen somebody drink blood or deer's blood or eat a heart. I think you can do it. I think the whole thing's a lie. He can't prove that he drank blood. This is all fabrication. So I know it's law and they make their arguments, but I found it kind of ridiculous that their argument was it'd be impossible to drink blood and hold it down.
Yeah, forget the argument. He made it up.
Yeah, he's a liar.
But the press likes it, and his first nickname was the vampire.
Oh, yeah. Blood sells papers.
We have the benefit of looking back and seeing this for what it was. This was a man who's quite lazy, and he wants to get on the fast track to wealth as easily as he can.
Yeah.
By not working. But as we talked about, they found all these different things. They found the hat pin. They found the gallstone. They found the dentures. They also found fat. Now, the fat, of course, doesn't just go away because of the acid. And it sticks around a lot longer than much of the other parts of the body.
It just depends on the size of the person too, and what's going to dissolve first. It's kind of morbid and gross, but there's always something that's going to be left. And I don't know if a lot of modern day, whether it be mafia hits or even TV shows such as Breaking Bad, were inspired by this, but you always see the dissolving of a body in a barrel now, and there's always something left. It's never just, oh, you just have acid left. There's sludge, and it's disgusting, and it's probably the most emotionless way to dispose of a body.
Because they have enough evidence to charge him with the murder of Mrs. Olive Henrietta Olivia Roberts Duran Deacon, he goes to court. His trial does not last long at all, does it?
No.
Took him less than 20 minutes to find him guilty.
Yeah, they didn't fall for his final con here, and they sentenced him to execution by hanging.
Yes, and he was hanged on August 10th of 1949. And Justin, what day is it today?
Huh, it's August 10th.
Huh. We didn't plan that, but it's just kind of interesting.
Yeah, so this is well before UK banned the death penalty. So John Hague is put to death.
I found this one interesting because this guy was different. Not different in that he was unique, but just there aren't too many killers that you read about who kill just for profit.
Yeah. He's labeled a serial killer. And I guess by textbook definition, he might qualify as such. But I think of a hitman or a mercenary who kills for profit. And I look at this guy and all I see is him killing for money and profit. I don't see him killing because of some craving or urge. It's a different mindset. He's a con man and he's looking for his next target for financial gain. And he just came up with the scheme of, well, I keep getting caught because they report the crime and they say it was me. So what can I do to prevent that from happening? Well, I'll dispose of the victim. But this isn't, I want to kill somebody. This is, I want to steal their money and I don't want to get caught. I'm kind of struggling with labeling this guy a serial killer. I don't think I would label a hitman or a mercenary or somebody else as a serial killer. And I don't think I'll label this guy as a serial killer either.
In the end, John made it clear that he was not religious. And I think that's important because he was brought up in a very religious household. And during his first number of incarcerations, he had stated to his parents that he was a believer and that he was going to try and redeem himself. And that never happened. His relationships weren't very good. But Barbara Stevens, the young girl that he had started dating when she was 15, she was at his execution in support of him. His parents knew at that point. He had gone to trial. It was proven that he was a murderer. It must have been very difficult for them to see their only son hanged for crimes that they could never have imagined that he would have committed. And I believe that they just didn't know their son. It's as though they knew he got into trouble, but perhaps it was just denial. I don't think that they ever really knew him as well as we've gotten to know him.
I have a lot of friends that are in the sales industry. It's definitely a particular mindset. I don't have it myself, but I hate to associate sales with con, but it's that mentality of always be closing. It's that mentality of you're not going to take no for an answer. And John Hague was of that mind to the point where he took it to the extreme.
John Hague was always calm. And a former accomplice of his once asked him why he was so calm all the time. Even when he failed, when he was caught in his schemes, John Hague's reply was, "I just look upon this as a temporary setback. All successful businessmen have them."
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.